Everybody thinks they know the Beatles, but how much do we really know? My name's Jason Carty.
My name's Stephen Cockcroft.
And we are the Beatle Brains of Ireland, and we host Nothing Is Real, a podcast about the Beatles.
We might look at Beatles albums, we might tell you what books you need to be taking on holiday. We've done an episode from Abbey Road Studios, and we do live shows.
We've also had guests on our podcast, like Beatles biographer Mark Lewison and singer-songwriter Robin Hitchcock. Search for Nothing Is Real on Acast, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Available 8 days a week.
Welcome to Nothing Is Real, a podcast about the Beatles. Everybody thinks they know the Beatles, but how much do we really know? My name is Jason Carty.
My name is Stephen Cockcroft.
And we are live on tape from Dublin. Today, we are going to talk about the Beatles' double A-sides. So, in the official Beatles singles canon from 1962 to 1970, in the UK, they put out 21 singles. 17 of those got to number one. But four of those singles were double A-sided singles. And each one came out at a different point in their career and tells a little bit of a different story. So we're going to look at those four singles today. Stephen, something I did not know until I started looking into it was that the Beatles invented the double A-sided single.
Yes, this had never happened before. This is essentially just to explain where each side of a 45 is designated as an A-side in its own right. Never been done before. I think it's indicative maybe the rivalry between John and Paul. You have two top-notch songwriters producing material. There's an embarrassment of riches. They're fighting over the primary spot.
Yeah, and it's, I mean, you're right. They're a group that was kind of perfectly designed for double A-sides because you have two A-side personalities trying to drive the group forward. Now, there were certainly instances in rock and roll of B-sides taking over and becoming the A-side. So Rock Around the Clock famously was a B-side originally until it became an A-side. But the first double A-sided single, as we know today, was, as I said, by the Beatles. And so let's just get stuck in. The first double A-side that they put out was on the 3rd of December 1965, and it was We Can Work It Out and Day Tripper. What is fascinating about this particular one is that it comes out on the exact same day as Rubber Soul, and neither song is featured on Rubber Soul. So that's quite a statement of intent.
It is, particularly when you consider that they were struggling to complete Rubber Soul. They were up against a deadline. They were running out of material, but it seems to have been the case that there was never any suggestion that these songs were going to be on the album itself. That's one of the things that the Beatles were known for, was not putting out a single where the material was already on an LP.
Yeah, and if you kind of look at the previous Decembers, so in December 63, they put out the With the Beatles album, and the single was I Want to Hold Your Hand. That single's not on the album. In December 64, they put out the Beatles For Sale album, and the single I Feel Fine. I Feel Fine is not on the album. And they're doing the same trick again in 1965 with a double A-side. Do you... I kind of never really think of those two songs, We Can Work It Out and Day Tripper, as being cut from the same cloth as Rubber Soul. I don't think they belong on Rubber Soul in a way.
No, I think I would agree with that. They have a different sound. Mm. Maybe it's just over familiarity with them, the idea that they are a single, they stand apart. But I think if you tried to slot them in to Rubber Soul, you know, if you dropped a track or two tracks off Rubber Soul, I think they would be quite jarring.
Yeah.
I think particularly Day Tripper, to me, is a slight hangover from sort of the Help era. Ticket to Ride and Day Tripper seem to me to sit quite comfortably together.
Yes.
We Can Work It Out, perhaps more of that sort of organic, acoustic Rubber Soul
feel to it.
Feel to it, yeah.
And I mean, Day Tripper, we kind of learned after the fact that it was sort of understood to have been written as a single. It's a bit formulaic from Lennon in terms of he knew they needed a single and this was how he went about doing it. Do you think that's a bit obvious in the song? Or
I do. I mean, I think what you've got, if you look at previous singles, you mentioned I Feel Fine, you've got Ticket to Ride. Day Tripper seems to sit, for me at least, seems to sit in that lineage. It's got a distinctive riff. I think it seems to me to be purpose written. As the next single.
Yes.
And I think this was we shouldn't underestimate the competition to have the next single within the band. You know, Lennon's was really dominating the songwriting up to Hard Day's Night. That was really the peak, I think, of his songwriting ability. suddenly then McCartney is coming up on the inside track. Mm. So competition for the next single, I think, is very fierce at this point.
And then, so to pair that with We Can Work It Out, they're both kind of two sides of a relationship coin. So you have Day Tripper, which is this kind of old school rocking Beatles, you know, it's a song about a girl. It's got that big teaser pun, which is kind of sticks out like a sore thumb, really. Yeah. It's a bit of an obnoxious joke. You can figure that pun out for yourselves. And, you know, it's dealing with, you know, kind of a classic pop song, imagined relationship. You know, here's the girl, this is the problem. We Can Work It Out is, it's very much about relationships, but it's phenomenally adult. I think We Can Work It Out is just one of the greatest singles they put out.
I would agree with that. And I think the interesting thing is Day Tripper is, I think, almost exclusively a Lennon song, whereas We Can Work It Out, there's a Lennon and McCartney. Lennon would have it that it was pretty much a 50-50
yes.
contribution. It's one of those increasingly by this stage rare examples of a true collaboration where they're throwing lines back and forward.
Yeah.
But yes, I think that's a good analogy, that this is it's McCartney is in a relationship with Jane Asher. He's living in central London. He's exploring more sophisticated songs, forms of songwriting. And I think he brings it to bear here. I think it's still... My take on the lyric is it's still quite self-serving in terms of, you know, the relationship. It's, you know, why do you have to argue with me? Why can you not say that I'm right?
That I'm Paul.
It's very Paul approach. But yes, I think it's one of those lines where you can see that they're moving into a more mature form of songwriting.
Yeah, because there's also, Paul had a couple of argument songs at this point, didn't he? He had a I'm Looking Through You. Wasn't that another Jane Asher? I've had an argument with Jane song.
Yep. Quite a few of them.
The thing I like about, you know, We Can Work It Out is, as you point out, it sort of has this, you know, as a reflection of Day Tripper, you know, you could say straightforward lyrics, straightforward musically, whereas We Can Work It Out is a bit more, it's got more subtleties. And so the musical backing is a lot more intricate and subtle, and there's a lot more going on. And I do love that feeling in We Can Work It Out that Paul is singing his bit, you know, try to see it my way. And then almost like a play,
yeah.
The light goes down on Paul and John is in the background as a Greek chorus. The light goes up on John and he's saying, you know, life is very short and there's no time. It's a great dramatic kind of framing device for something that's very real.
It is. And I mean, I think that the change in tempo as well, the sort of slight waltz section in the middle, introduces that sense of drama. I should at this point that was George's contribution, was to
put in the little 3-4 bit.
Was put a little 3-4 bit. So Paul would say that he came with the verses.
Yes.
That he and John then wrote the middle 8 section, but it was George's idea. Well, let's just change the change the tempo there.
And they're actually, you know, when I was thinking about it before coming in, you know, to talk about it today, there aren't that many Beatles songs where Paul sings a bit and John sings a bit. There's actually a handful of them, and it's a very powerful device. The only ones I could think of were you've got A Day in the Life, you've got maybe She's Leaving Home, where John has his backing vocal, you've got All Together Now, where Paul sings a bit and John sings a bit, Birthday, Paul sings a bit, John sings a bit, and of course Free as a Bird.
I've Got a Feeling.
Ah, yes, I've Got a Feeling, which is another.
And again, it's two songs
put together,
two fragments put together, and they're each singing their own bit.
But that's a great kind of collection of songs where they're kind of playing off each other. They're kind of perfect tracks. So this double A-side comes out on the same day as Rubber Soul, which is a very much, considering how quickly Rubber Soul came together and how fraughtly it came together, and we might have a Rubber Soul podcast at some point in the future. It's quite a, you know, if you were from the outside not knowing where, you know, the work that they had put into that, it's quite a height of their powers type statement to put out the 14 tracks of Rubber Soul and this now not one A-side, two A-side singles right at the end of 65. Because there's this issue in 1965 where competition starts to appear on the horizon for the Beatles. So maybe not from an album sense, but certainly on the singles charts, you're starting to get great hits from The Who and The Rolling Stones and The Kinks, and all these people are starting to come into their stride in 65. So they're not the only guys in town anymore. So it's a, you know, I think, you know, compared to what's coming out at the time, how do you think they all stand up?
I think that's exactly right. I think 65 always for me is the year in which it's British pop sort of comes of age, and it's really coalesces around the single, the groups that you've mentioned. And something that we talked about before in a previous episode was just was help.
Yes.
And the fact that that was a little lightweight.
Mm.
That it's a transitional album. They must have been extremely conscious of the competition.
Yes.
The Stones, the Who, the Kinks. Also, as you say, this slightly harder edge. So you have the Animals, you know, you've got them, mm-hmm. the Kinks. It's a rock sound. And the interesting thing is Day Tripper to me is the sort of end of that straight rock sound for the Beatles. We Can Work It Out, as you say, is this more sophisticated sound. And I think this is a very powerful response to that sense of challenge that they must have been feeling. Also, you're looking at what's happening in the States at that time. So that first wave of that British invasion where the Beatles were conquering everything before them, you now have American bands.
Yes,
are
coming back.
So, you know, you've got the Byrds, you've got Dylan. We're sort of 12 months away from the sort of West Coast Jefferson Airplane is coming out. So there is a huge sense, I think, that the first wave of Beatlemania is subsiding. It's reached its peak. So they're moving streets ahead of the competition. I think Rubber Soul and this single really sort of put them out in front again.
Yeah, and the cover versions are gone. You know, they're not rocking out anymore. As we said in the Help podcast, you know, they end with Dizzy Miss Lizzy at the end of Help. And it's like, goodbye to all of that. And, you know, because still a lot of their contemporaries were still knee deep in cover versions, particularly when they're trying to fill up albums at the time. Now, the songs, I haven't really found a definitive reason as to why these songs were a double A-side. It seems to be that there was some misunderstanding about the two songs, about whether one should have been the A-side or one should have been the B-side, perhaps with Day Tripper being the B-side. There's one story I've read where there was some kind of disagreement between John Lennon and EMI. I don't know. Do you know any of the specifics?
No, I mean, my understanding is that Lennon came in with Day Tripper as this is the next single.
Yeah.
McCartney then produced his We Can Work It Out. They finished the song. I suspect that George Martin was probably put in the slightly invidious position of having to say, yeah, I like this one or I like that one.
Yes.
But my strong feeling is there was just such competition between the two of them. Lennon was adamant that Day Tripper was going to be the single. We Can Work It Out was the more popular song in the long run. That's the one that I think won the Ivor Novello Award. Mm-hmm. This is the song that these days it would be the most downloads. It got the most radio play.
Yeah.
So I think that's a situation where Paul won that one.
Yeah, good old Paul. It's worth pointing out that there are videos for both of those songs. There's actually more than one video for each of the songs, which are basic in television studio recordings of them performing the songs. But probably one of my favourite Beatle moments is at the end of the We Can Work It Out video, where John Lennon is just making Paul McCartney laugh, which is one of my favourite Beatle moments, where they're just totally kind of ruining it for each other. John's trying to play the harmonium with his elbows. Paul is genuinely, you know, given up for the day in terms of trying to get any work done. So we can pull up a YouTube link to that video. So that's the first double A-side single. Comes out at the end of 1965. Comes out on the same day as a totally different but artistically successful album, Rubber Soul. We then jump forward to August 1966, the 5th of August 1966. The next double A-side single that the Beatles put out is Eleanor Rigby and Yellow Submarine. And that double A-side single comes out on the same day as Revolver. And, as you probably know, both Eleanor Rigby and Yellow Submarine this time, they are on Revolver. So they're releasing a single from the album on the same day as the album. I've always felt as a single, I kind of forget that it's a single in a way. Maybe this time around I do pair it more with the album. It just seems to be a bit opportunistic, and it also shows how little they actually put out in 1966.
I think we mentioned earlier that they tended to put standalone singles out. They simply seem not to have had the material here. I've always had very mixed feelings about both songs. Slightly heretical, but I'm not sure I would be averse to snipping them off Revolver and keeping them as a standalone single.
Okay.
you know, I think that might have been a better approach.
Yes.
You know, you've got a unashamedly children's song in Yellow Submarine. Eleanor Rigby is McCartney. Again, it's like yesterday. It's almost like a solo McCartney performance with strings. It doesn't sound like anything the Beatles have done before. Neither mm-hmm. of them really sound like anything the Beatles have done before. I think they make an interesting single. It's probably a testament to their the scale of their popularity that it got to number one. I'm not sure if it had been released by anybody else, it would have got to number one.
Well, I imagine, you know, there's probably something about the two songs, Eleanor Rigby and Yellow Submarine, that we take for granted today. You know, I imagine they were very striking songs to hear in 1966. If you were playing the fun 1966 game of what are the Beatles going to do next, then, you know, you wouldn't have guessed Yellow Submarine and Eleanor Rigby were the next things out of the, you know, like a chamber music, you know, string song, and then a children's song about a, you know, an imagined submarine. It's an interesting setup. But yeah, compared to their 1965, 1966, they don't put out a lot. They put out the 14 songs that make up Revolver, and they put out one other single from the start of the Revolver sessions, Paperback Writer and Rain.
Yeah.
And so Yellow Submarine, Eleanor Rigby seems like kind of an opportunistic single. It doesn't really, you know, if it's on the album, it almost doesn't need to exist.
I think so. I for me, Paperback Writer and Rain would sit more comfortably on Revolver than these two. But yes, I think it probably was that they needed a single. They didn't have the material, so they're going to release an album track, and that was really not their normal way of working.
Do you think there's any other song on Revolver that could have worked as a single or as a double A-side single? Is there any?
It's hard to say. I like the pairing of Paperback Writer and Rain. I think maybe something like Andrew Bird Can Sing might have made a good single track. But Revolver is one of those albums where it's sort of difficult to see where the single the single is. And I suppose at this remove, you see these albums as complete things, so it's difficult to conceive of hearing one of those songs outside the context of the album.
Yeah.
It's not a commercial album, I think, Revolver.
It's certainly not the obvious next step.
No, it's not the obvious next step. And if for example, Yellow Submarine and Eleanor Rigby had come out a month or two before Revolver, they wouldn't give you any clue as to what Revolver was going to sound like.
Yes. And maybe that would have been a better option, is to kind of spread them out a little bit differently and then decide whether or not to put them on the record. Now, obviously, those two songs did not have any kind of contemporary video made for them at the time. So they kind of, again, you know, the singles around them did have films and videos made for them, which we can kind of put in place a little bit more. So maybe that's why they kind of step back a little bit.
The other thing that I remember, the first Beatles album I ever got was a collection of oldies.
Oh, yes.
And the last tracks are Yellow Submarine and Eleanor Rigby, and they stick out like a sore thumb. You know, this was intended to round up the singles, the non-album tracks. And I remember, even as a sort of 10 or 11 year old, when I bought that, thinking this would sound so much better if, as an album, if those two songs
weren't there.
But clearly it was just, I don't see the reason for putting it, put it, because they're on Revolver.
Don't they also finish the Red album as well, the 62 to 66 compilation, aren't they, right?
Yes,
at the end
that's it. Can I give you my theory about my theory, but can I give you my my niece's theory about the writing of Yellow Submarine?
Have I
told you this theory before?
I don't believe so.
Whenever she was five or six, can I say hello, Libby? She,
no, you can't.
She, oh, okay, we can edit that out. She and her brother were big fans of Thunderbirds.
Oh yeah,
and the original. You know, I was forcing them like a good uncle to watch outdated 1960s puppetry. And she said to me, "Is Thunderbird 4, which is a little small yellow submarine, the same yellow submarine that the Beatles live on?" And I couldn't answer that question, so I went and I did some.
Yes.
Research.
Yes.
You know, all good podcasters do their research. So Thunderbird 4 makes its first appearance in March of 1966. And Ian MacDonald has Paul McCartney in bed at Jane Asher's house, writing this song in April 1966.
Hmm.
So my theory, Libby's theory,
yes,
is, until anyone else can come up with a better theory, is that Paul McCartney saw Thunderbirds and wrote Yellow Submarine.
Because Yellow Submarine is a Paul Wright mainly, isn't it? It's not a John song, it's a Paul song.
And, of course, Donovan.
Claim to have done for Yellow Submarine?
Well, he came up with the line, sky of blue, sea of green. He doesn't like to talk about it.
No, he doesn't.
He really doesn't
like to talk.
He's very reticent
about
his
involvement
with the Beatles. But he came up with, and even John, to be fair, even John said Donovan was there writing.
Because I think when John, the previous year, was having his first LSD experiences, they at one point thought they were on submarines and they were having all that kind of
sensation. So it could be a flashback.
So there could be a bit of that as well.
And the backing vocalists, can we mention just quick credit for vocalists?
Who do we have there?
So you've got Mal Evans.
Yes, Beatles roadie.
George Martin.
Producer.
Jeff Emmerich.
Engineer.
Neil Aspinall.
Beatles gopher.
Alf Bicknell.
Driver.
John's chauffeur.
Right.
Paddy Boyd.
George's wife.
Brian Jones.
From the Rolling Stones.
Marianne Faithfull.
Paramour
of several Stones. And Brian Epstein.
Wow, so. I didn't know Brian Epstein was on there as well.
There you go.
That's a good crew. I have one other thing, which is I'd listened to Yellow Submarine for about 30 years, and you know that kind of the voices in the background bit. There's a bit that goes about halfway through the song. I had never paid any attention to this, and one of my own kids pointed out, "Oh, he's saying tickets, tickets." And I went back and listened to the song. Now, every time I hear Yellow Submarine, when I get to that noise, I'm like, oh, yeah, it is somebody shouting, tickets, tickets. And nobody'd ever pointed that out to me before. So go back and listen to Yellow Submarine and tell us we're right. So we talk about these songs finishing up the 62 to 66 compilation album. And then the next double A side is the next single. And they are the two songs that open up the 67 to 70 compilation and, possibly kick open the door to the second half of the Beatles' career. And some people say it's the greatest double A side of all time and it's the pinnacle of all human achievement. And of course, it's the double A side of Strawberry Fields Forever and Penny Lane, which was released on the 13th of February 1967. And unlike the previous two double A side singles, which were in one way or another connected to an album, Strawberry Fields Forever, Penny Lane comes out as a double A side on its own, nothing else to distract it from. And, well, how do you can't criticise Strawberry Fields and Penny Lane, can you, Stephen?
You can't. I would agree it's probably the best single they ever came up with. And the irony of it stalling at number two, it broke, I think, from Please Please Me. It was the first one not to get to number one.
Yeah.
And there is a sort of dreadful irony in that it was Engelbert Humperdinck.
Please Release Me by Engelbert Humperdinck keeps it off the number one spot in the UK.
Yeah.
And it's still something, I think, if you're a true Beatles fan, it still kind of sticks in the core a little bit.
It does. I was very upset they didn't re-release it as a single on the 50th anniversary, because I think we could have got it to number one.
I remember myself and Stephen at the end of 2016 were talking about what would it take to get Strawberry Fields and Penny Lane to number one for its 50th anniversary.
Yeah.
And we tweeted loads of people. One night on Twitter, just thought we'll just try and contact as many people as possible. And we got Sean Lennon.
Sean Lennon came back. We said, any chance. And he went, I'm the last person to have any influence over anything to do with Apple or the Beatles. He seemed quite bitter about that.
Well, I think realistic would be maybe a better term. But
I did send an email to the CEO of Apple. Yeah, he didn't get back to me.
That's a pity. I got a nice response from Pete Pafides, the journalist.
Sent
me a big long DM about getting singles re-released, which was very nice. But they didn't re-release it. What they did do was put out a single on the 50th anniversary for Record Store Day as a precursor to the 50th anniversary of the Sgt. Pepper box set coming out. But there wasn't any effort to push it back into the charts. There's probably not an awful lot about Strawberry Fields Forever or Penny Lane that needs to be said, but it certainly comes, roughly 6 months after the previous double A side of Eleanor Rigby and Yellow Submarine. And it's for people who, at this point in their career, the Beatles had, they'd finished touring in August 1966. They had taken about a 3 month or thereabouts break at the end of 1966. John goes off and films his part in the movie How I Won the War in Almeria, where he starts writing Strawberry Fields, and Ringo takes some time off and visits John in Almeria. Doesn't really, I think he, does he start his hairdressers at this point, Ringo? I can't remember.
Opens a second hairdresser.
There you go. George goes off to India and visits the Taj Mahal and all the rest. And Paul McCartney writes a soundtrack to a movie, The Family Way, because Paul works. That's what Paul does.
That's what he does.
He's just great. And then they come together at the end of November 1966, and the first three songs they put together are Strawberry Fields Forever, When I'm 64, and Penny Lane. And obviously these two songs, people are wondering, you know, are the Beatles done? Are they finished? What's going to happen next? You know, it's a 6 month gap between singles, and then when they come out, it must have been sensational at the time.
Yeah, because I think, yes, to put it in context, people were speculating. I mean, there's a clip that they show regularly, every Beatles documentary, of each of them arriving at Abbey Road Studios,
yes,
and the reporter saying, you know,
what are you up to next?
What are you up to now? You're all going to do separate things. You're going to. So there was speculation that really they'd stopped touring. Mm-hmm. That this was it. So they'd peaked and they were all going to go off and do their own things. And
that was probably a national sport, though, about when is this Beatles thing going to stop?
Yeah, I think, you know, it had been, what, sort of three and a half, 4 years at this point. So, and, you know, McCartney sort of says, you know, well, we knew we had Sgt. Pepper sort of in our pocket. We knew we were going to absolutely, you know, blow their minds with this album. But the context of the two singles, perhaps, is that these should have been album tracks. These were being recorded specifically for Sgt. Pepper, specifically for the album. Mm. The idea was to write Liverpool-themed songs or songs about their childhood. Pepper, I think, it is that whole sort of era of childhood and Alice in Wonderland and Lewis Carroll and all of that going on, and then they're under pressure. They need a single. The record company, you know, Sir Joe needs a single, and Epstein is under pressure. He puts George Martin under pressure, and George Martin pulls the two songs and says, well, okay, there you go, that's the single. To his regret.
It is an interesting thing. First of all, I don't believe that Strawberry Fields Forever and Penny Lane should have been on Pepper. I see that they're part of the time, but I think almost as the opposite to Eleanor Rigby and Yellow Submarine, I think their form as this perfect double A side is, you know, as good a statement as you could make.
I think so, and I think the point that you made at the sort of the starting talk here is that this really kicks the door open for the second, maybe the middle half,
yes,
of their three halves of their career. I think given the length of time without any new product, this is a collection of oldies had come out, so that was clearly a stopgap.
Yep.
People are speculating, then suddenly something completely different, completely unexpected, which served then only to increase anticipation for Pepper that would come out in June.
So it's always worth reminding ourselves that, you know, when Brian Epstein, you know, envisaged how the Beatles would work, you know, they released their first single at the end of 62, and 4 years later, from 4 years on from Love Me Do, they're recording Strawberry Fields Forever. And what Brian Epstein had envisaged would be two albums a year, four singles a year, and he managed that for 63, 64, 65, 66, one album, one separate single, and now there's this big long 6 month gap. And so rock and roll is only just over a decade old, so to speak, so 6 months is an age. So the pressure to put out that single, they really delivered. And of course they didn't present themselves on television, they didn't do any gigs or concerts to it. They put out these two rather fantastic videos that still stand out as videos today.
I always think this is the start of the video age. These are two little concept pieces, specifically filmed. Yeah,
there's something. The Strawberry Fields Forever starts the video starts a trope that then appears in videos for the next 12 or 24 months, which is bands sitting in a forest at a fully set table having their dinner, which is something that loads of psychedelic bands were doing in '67. The Move, and I think Traffic and all these other guys were kind of
Pink Floyd have a video that does that?
Probably, yeah. This sort of, we're in the middle of nature with some sort of piece of the real world. So there's the Pink Floyd video where they're on a beach with a mannequin and all that kind of stuff. Once again, the Beatles set that up where they're just sitting in a forest having a fully set dinner, and Mal Evans appears, doesn't he, in that, and hands them their instruments. So, yeah, Strawberry Fields Forever, Penny Lane. Chances are, if you're listening to this podcast, you know these songs back to front. And, you know, we might touch upon them again in the future when we do a Pepper podcast. But so far, if you look at these three AA sites to date, they've all been released in different circumstances. One with an album, but not on the album. One with an album and on the album. One just standing alone. That kind of leads us on to the fourth and final AA side, which comes out in October 1969. And so the final AA side single that the Beatles put out is Something and Come Together. And compared to the other ones, this is a single, AA-sided single that comes out when the album is already in the charts and the album's already been released, albeit for about a fortnight at that point. And this song doesn't get to number one, certainly doesn't get to number one in the UK as a result
of
that.
Number four.
This wouldn't have happened on Brian Epstein's watch, would it?
No, I think not. I think this, although it was denied at the time, I think this is very much Alan Klein, who had come in as their manager, looking for a quick cash return. Mm. Off the top of my head, I can't think of another occasion in which they released a single off an album that was already out. Possibly in America, this was happening. The Capitol were a law unto themselves. But certainly in the UK, this was something new. And it was an accusation that was levelled at the time that Klein had to deny.
Yes. It seems to have been not a very well-planned AA side single. I think it seems that once Abbey Road started to circulate, so Abbey Road came out, I think, the 26th of September 69, but it had certainly been played and on the airwaves for the previous 2 to 3 weeks, and there had been listening parties in Apple, and so people were aware of it. I don't believe that it was planned very far out that these two songs would be pulled for a double A-side, and that the success of Something, which of course Something was written by George Harrison, and George Harrison had written maybe two B-sides to date, but he'd never written a Beatles A-side, and here he is right at the tail end of their career, sticking down his flag and saying, I'm as good as anything else. And obviously Something is Something. It's just...
I think Something sort of really is George coming into his own as a songwriter. And that was really the point that Klein was making. So I think in Mark Lewison's book, the Complete Recording Sessions, he makes the... point that this was a money-grabbing exercise, and Klein, this would have been 1990, Klein writes to Mark Lewison.
Oh, right.
Saying, no, absolutely not. This was purely a mark of Lennon's regard for the song, Something, and this is a quote, to point out George as a writer and give him the courage to go in and do his own LP. So it was just a purely altruistic step by Lennon, who was...
Lennon and Klein, too. Altruistic
people. Absolutely.
Yes. I think it sets a precedent, though, for them not being at number one. So the previous single to have come out was The Ballad of John and Yoko, which was number one back in June.
But I think it was released when Get Back was still at number one.
Yeah.
So, you know, that makes no commercial sense.
Well, The Ballad of John Yoko is, I could talk about that for about an hour itself. I'm a huge fan of that song. I think it's like this curious little anomaly in the Beatle world.
So that's a podcast in itself.
We could do a podcast on The Ballad of John Yoko.
Okay.
But it's hard to put a finger on, you know, there was an awful lot of wheels moving in the Beatles world in September 69. And we've talked about this a bit on our 1970 podcast, where, you know, Klein is signing them into a deal in September 69. Lennon finally says, I want out. You know, Klein's trying to manipulate EMI to give them better royalties. That's coming into play as well. But if they are a band who are, you know, coming into the downward slope of wrapping up, you know, for a single not to get to number one, it kind of does. It's obviously the end of an era.
I think so. And in that context, the little video clip, the promo clip that they have for that is interesting as well, where you have the four Beatles and their respective partners wandering around, but they're not in the same shot. So it's made up of sort of separately filmed performances, not performances, but just them literally wandering around. And yeah. I think at this stage, McCartney and Linda are in Scotland.
They filmed their scenes in Scotland.
And just sent them down. And we've mentioned a couple of times on podcasts, Rob Sheffield.
Yes.
And his book, Dreaming the Beatles, which every good home should have at least one copy. He has a comment on the significance of the video. So he says, each couple is projecting a totally different vibe. Mm. George and Patty peacocking in their hippie royalty finery. Paul and Linda on the farm. Ringo and Maureen kind of goofing around on little motorbikes. John and Yoko dressed in these sort of imposing black robes. And what he says is each Beatle looks like he's found what he was looking for.
Yeah.
But they're heading in four separate directions for four separate futures. And I think that's probably as symbolic as anything else of what was happening at the time.
Yeah, and it's a video that was put together. So the last time the Beatles are together in a studio working is August 1969. But the Beatles as an entity is still making a video even in four totally separate
yeah.
streams and trying to shoehorn it together. There's still Beatles things coming out.
I think they're maintaining that image for the public. And I think, again, back to Klein, that was something he was very adamant that even though he knew when he was renegotiating the contract, he knew when all this was going on that they were falling apart, that Lennon had already said he was going to leave.
Yep.
But in order for him to sort of carry out his machinations with EMI and yeah. what have you, they had to present this united front even though they were falling apart.
And we're leaning a lot here on something as if it's the presumptive A side, but it is a double A side. You have Come Together on the other side, which is a John single. So you now had, with the Bad of John Yoko and Come Together, you've kind of got two John A sides when Paul had a run of A sides in the lead up to that. Come Together, one of the few Beatles songs that John performed when he was solo.
Yeah, at the Madison Square Garden's one-to-one concert.
Yeah. And it's unusual not to have Paul in the driving seat. He's trying to make himself noticed on both songs.
Yes.
I think George never really was a huge fan of what Paul was playing on the bass on something, even though it's a bit ornate. And obviously Paul's very much to the fore with his harmonies and his bass in Come Together. But it's odd not to have Mr. Showbiz on the driving seat of a Beatles single for
yeah.
the first time in a very long time.
Yeah. I think he is, as you say, he's trying to make himself apparent.
Yes,
I'm here, waving from the back row.
So as I said, that set a precedent in the UK because it didn't get to number one. And then the next final Beatles single in the UK was Let It Be, which came out in May 1970, 2 months before the album. So that did precede the album, and that didn't get to number one either. So, you know, it's kind of the end of them as kind of an active group. They stop getting number one, so they stop putting out singles.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, in a way, it's a shame that the last two singles sort of don't get to number one. I suppose there's an argument for saying, well, you know, if people had already bought the album, I don't suppose anyone who bought the album would have been expecting two songs to be pulled as a single. Let It Be is slightly different in that it's a different mix and there's a B-side that isn't available elsewhere. But
obviously Let It Be and The Long and Winding Road get to number one in America.
Yeah.
But we obviously follow the UK canon here.
Yes, Americans will buy anything. I would be tempted to sort of think, well, what if they had put something out as a standalone single with a B-side, maybe Come Together as a separate single with a B-side. You know, there were songs kicking around at that stage that they could easily have put something on.
Something. Yes.
They could have put some other song on the B-side, which would have given an incentive to the record-buying public. You know, this is, the B-sides were always worth hearing.
Yeah. So these four double A sides, they each kind of reflect a different bit of light from a different stage in the Beatles story. I suppose to wrap up, Stephen, are there any Beatles singles that you think should have been double A sides? Is there any Beatles single where you think this B side is good enough to be an A side? I know where my vote is. My vote goes to Hey Jude Revolution. I think
That's
should have been a double A side.
That's the only one that kind of springs to mind.
Yeah.
That of released singles that I think could also have been a double A side.
Yeah, I know some people think Paperback Writer and Rain, but I think Rain has a certain cachet from being a B side.
Rain, I think it doesn't have a commercial sense about it. I think it's probably
the greatest B-side.
It's
in a
the
way.
Greatest B-side. I think it's, you know, Ringo always says it's his favorite performance as a drummer. I think it's a better song than Paperback Writer. It's a better production than Paperback Writer. But no, I don't think it's A-side or double A-side material.
Yeah. Okay. So listen, we're going to put up some YouTube links to all of these singles and all the things we've been talking about today on our Twitter feed. Hopefully, you found that interesting. The four Beatles double A-side singles. If you've got any thoughts about any other songs that should have been double A-sides, or you want to make up your own fantasy Beatle double A-sides, let us know. So that's it, the Beatles double A-sides. This has been Nothing Is Real. My name is Jason Carty.
My name is Stephen Cockcroft.
Thanks for joining us. Please get in touch. We're on Twitter, at BeatlesPod. You can search for us on Facebook and in all the usual places. Please keep subscribing, telling your friends and listening to the podcast, and we will see you next time on Nothing Is Real. Thanks for listening to Nothing Is Real. We hope you enjoyed today's episode, and if you did, why not become a member? You'll get access to ad-free content, bonus episodes, and so much more. Follow the link in the show notes, sign up on Acast Plus, or visit our website, nothingisrealpod.com.